Ki jai Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki jai Prem Shri Gaur Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki jai Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki jai Vrindavan Dhamma Ki jai Mathura Dhamma Ki jai Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki jai Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki jai Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki jai Bhakti Devi Ki jai Tulsi Maharani Ki jai Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki jai Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasaya Bhujale Sri Mati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namani. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Bachani Namaste Sasanyani Paskatyade Siddharani. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Cha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Mohita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchakalpa Chubhishta Kipasan Vyavatapti Chinam Pavanevya Vaishnavi Mohama Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Is today August 1st?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So August 1st, 2018 in Zagreb, Croatia. And we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 11, Lord Krishna's Entrance into Dwarka, Text 9. Yeah, it's really hard. It took me like 5 tries trying to do it in my mind before I could say it. Kurun madun vata suridrikshaya.
Kurun madun vata suridrikshaya.
Tatrabda koti pratimakshano bhaved.
Tatrabda koti pratimakshano bhaved.
Ravim vinakshur ivanastavachuta.
Ravim vinakshur.
Yarhi. Whenever. Ambuja aksha. O lotus eyed one. Apasasara. You go away. Bho. O. Bhavan, yourself, Kurun, the descendants of King Kuru, Madhun, the descendants of Mathura, Brajbhumi, Va, either, Ata, therefore, Surit Dirikshaya, for meeting them, Tatra, at that time, Abdakoti, millions of years, Pratimaha, like, Shanaha, moments, Bhavet, becomes, Ravim, the sun, Vina, without, Akshnaho, of the eyes, Eva, like that, Naha, ours, Tava, your, Achyuta, O infallible one. So, in the last verse, they were saying, the residents of Dwarka were saying how wonderful it is to see Krishna. In this verse, they're saying how terrible it is not to see Krishna. A translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O lotus-eyed Lord, whenever you go away to Mathura, Vrindavan, or Hastinapur to meet your friends and relatives, every moment of your absence seems like a million years. O infallible one, at that time, our eyes become useless, as if bereft of sun. Purport. It's always interesting. We're all talking about vision. Useless eyes. Purport. We are all proud of our material senses for making experiments to determine the existence of God. But we forget that our senses are not absolute by themselves. They can only act under certain conditions. For example, our eyes. There you go. Look at that.
I don't understand.
Prabhupada said we're all proud of our eyes, and we were just talking before class how we get proud of our eyes. As long as the sunshine is there, our eyes are useful to a certain extent. But in the absence of sunshine, the eyes are useless. Lord Sri Krishna, being the primeval Lord, the Supreme Truth, is compared to the sun. Without him, all our knowledge is either false or partial. The opposite of the sun is the darkness, and similarly, the opposite of Krishna is Maya or illusion. The devotees of the Lord can see everything in true perspective due to the light disseminated by Lord Krishna. By the grace of the Lord, the pure devotee cannot be in the darkness of ignorance. Therefore, it is necessary that we must always be in the sight of Lord Krishna so that we can see both ourselves and the Lord with his different energies. As we cannot see anything in the absence of the sun, so also we cannot see anything, including our own self, without the factual presence of the Lord. Without him, all our knowledge is covered by illusion. Yaryam bhujaksha pasasara bo bhavan kun madun yatasurid rikshaya tat rabdakoti pratima kshano bhavet ravim vinakshar ivanastava chita. O Lotus Eyed Lord, whenever you go away to Mathura, Vrindavana, or Hastinapur to meet your friends and relatives, every moment of your absence seems like a million years. O infallible one, at that time, our eyes become useless as if bereft of sun. So I remember one time we were visiting my husband's family in the northern part of Michigan in America, and that area is called Copper Country because there were used to be, anyway, big copper mines. So we took a tour of this abandoned copper mine, and you go underground and you can't see at all. I mean, it's such utter, complete, and total darkness. It's not the kind of darkness that we normally experience. Right? Generally, when there's darkness, there's... do you need the translation? Yeah. It's nice. Okay. I can speak much more slowly.
For just a short time.
Yes. So I will drive with one foot on the brake. I'll drive in first gear. So in our normal life, we don't experience that level of darkness. At night, or even in a dark room, you can have room darkening shades. It's not that dark. But in a mine under the earth, you couldn't see anything at all. I mean, just absolutely nothing at all. So, no matter how good one's eyes are, or how expert the maker of one's glasses, without the sun, we're blind. And this is true for all of our senses. In fact, it's described a little later actually, in the Bhagavatam, in the second canto, with the universal form, that when the senses of the universal form become active, the corresponding senses of the living entity can work. They're not able to work independently. And this makes sense when you consider that we are all parts of the universal body of the Lord. You know, when we go to sleep, the different cells in our body also slow down. Our body temperature drops. I mean, if you think about it, why do we usually want some covers? You know, we're in a room where we don't need to wear a sweater or a jumper, but at night we want some covers. So our body temperature goes down, our breathing goes down, our digestion goes down. That's why if you eat before you go to sleep, you're going to tend to gain weight and have a sluggish digestion because we don't digest so well at night. When Lord Brahma goes to sleep, the universe becomes partially destroyed because the universe is considered to be his body. So this is part of what we mean by a conditioned soul, that we are dependent. The form that we have is very dependent on what's happening and the conditions around us. And of course, even with the sun, our physical eyes, as Prabhupada says, are limited. We can see only certain forms of light. So there are creatures who can see forms of light that we can't. You know, there are insects who can see parts of the ultraviolet and infrared spectrum that we can't see. Just like there are animals that can hear sounds which we cannot hear. You know, they're there. Where there's so many things that our senses are not able to be aware of. Like right now in this room, there's all kinds of waves. You know, there's television waves. If you had a television set, you could catch them. There's radio waves. But we're not aware of them. We're not even aware of the air, you know, that's all around us. We can't feel it. It's pressing on our body. It's actually quite strong pressure on every part of our body. But we don't have an awareness of it. So therefore Prabhupada said, without Krishna, our knowledge is either false or partial. And of course, partial knowledge in one sense is also false. You know, if you have some, like this painting here, if you could only see a very small portion of it, you would have a false idea of the painting. The analogy is given like the six blind men with the elephant. One of them goes to the side, one goes to the leg, one goes to the trunk, one goes to the tail. And one of them says, oh, an elephant is like a wall. No, no, no. An elephant is like a pillar. Ah, an elephant is like a snake. No, an elephant is like a rope. One on the ear says, oh, an elephant is like a fan. So partial knowledge, just like in a court, you make a promise, I will tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So not only truth, but complete truth and truth not mixed with lies. And this difficulty of sense perception is one of the big problems with science, whether it's the hard sciences or the soft sciences. So as a scientist, I myself am a scientist in the soft sciences, and one of the things that they taught us in the PhD level was the limits and the difficulties of the empiric or the scientific method. It was interesting because at the end of teaching us why the scientific method cannot give you truth, then they tell us, now go out and use it. Because they don't know any other way of acquiring knowledge. And it was also interesting to me that at the master's level, they didn't talk about this. You know, at the bachelor's, the undergraduate, and the master's level, pretty much whatever is understood through research and the scientific method is presented as true. And once we got to the PhD level, then we took this class about how it's not true. You know, so the scientists themselves are admitting that their knowledge is either false or partial. As I say, partial truth, it's not truth. So you may come up with theories that are consistent within that partial understanding. There was a book we were required to read in the doctoral program, a very well-known book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. It's a difficult book to read. Without some sort of study guide, it was very difficult. But it's a classic in the field of science. And basically, Thomas Kuhn says that there's some theory, and people accept the theory as fact. Then within that theory, they do scientific research. And basically, they're researching things that they expect to be true within that theory. In other words, they're not doing research to challenge their theory. They're doing research to confirm their theory. And because the research they do is within the theory, it generally confirms the theory. Then over time, people notice things that are outside the theory, that are anomalous to the theory, that don't fit the theory. Generally, those things are simply ignored or discredited. In time, if enough of those anomalous evidences build up, then rather than changing the current theory to try to accommodate them, there's a revolution and an entirely new theory is developed to explain the things that couldn't be explained by the first theory. There then becomes a war, a battle, between the adherents of the first theory and the adherents of the new theory. And because so many scientists had based their career on the first theory, they're not willing to give it up, no matter what evidence they are faced with. And generally, therefore, the new theory doesn't become prominent until the scientists who propounded the old theory have died or retired. Then the new theory becomes prominent, and again, the same thing. It is assumed to be true. Research is done within that theory to confirm that theory rather than to challenge it. That becomes what everybody's doing. Anomalous things are ignored or discredited until again they build up and again a new theory is proposed. So what this means, if we were looking at this painting, would mean we have, if we're looking at just a certain piece of the painting, we come up with a theory about what the painting is. And as long as we research within that one piece, our theory will be consistent and our experiments will be true. But if somebody looks outside of that little window of the painting to the other parts, they'll challenge, right? If you just looked at the sky, you'd say this is a light blue and white painting. And someone who looks at the leaves will say, no, actually, it's a green painting. And the problem is that one can never understand truth as a whole with this method. The only thing you can say is, so far, according to our knowledge and experiments, it is not false. But actually, through using our senses, one can never say this is true. Since studying these things, I have pretty much stopped using the word proof and started to use the word evidence instead. So these things can't be proved true. They can only be shown so far. They are not false. Another problem is that we never know what we don't know. We don't know what we don't know. So we are not even aware. You know, there may be kinds of light and sound which we have not measured. Not only is there light and sound that we know is there, but we cannot see it or hear it because we have instruments which can extend the range of our senses. But could there be sights and sounds that are beyond the range of our instruments, that we're not aware of their existence at all? And also, many of our explanations, especially when we try to explain something that's very removed from our senses, because the scientific method is you hear, you see, you smell, you taste, you touch something, you mess with it in various ways, and other people can repeat what you've done because, you know, we have our own biases. But if you have lots of scientists repeat it, then you're supposed to be able to overcome the biases. But what about subjects which are very far away in space and time? So all science that deals with origins is in this category. Any science that deals with the creation of the universe, the beginning of the universe, the beginning of life, the beginning of life forms, the structure of the universe, the distance of the stars, the composition of the stars, any science that deals with, or human history, what did humans do thousands of years ago, none of those kinds of science are open to repeatable experiments. You can't do an experiment about what happened in the past. If you want, you can dig up some artifacts and you can say, it looks like this artifact means this. But there's no possible experiment you can do to find that out. You know, if you're looking at the stars, you can use different mathematical formulas and different known laws of mathematics, chemistry, physics on this planet, but one cannot assume that those laws operate on other planets, nor can one assume that what one sees from a great distance is what's actually there. And there, again, there's no experiment. You can't take the stars and planets and subject them to your experiments. You can't do it. So the greater questions of life, science is extremely useful for interbreeding plants and, you know, building smartphones and automobiles. And I mean, it's a very useful, it's useful for those things. But even for those things, we see that much of what modern science has given us in terms of material comforts and technology have come with some sort of health or environmental cost that was not anticipated by the people who made the inventions. Yes? It just didn't anticipate, if we make this thing, how will this affect human beings? I mean, a very good example is antibiotics. So antibiotics just transformed medicine in unbelievably wonderful ways. But who could have guessed that they would have created superbugs? So at the time that antibiotics and vaccines were first developed, the mood in the world was, this is going to eliminate disease. It hasn't eliminated disease, and in fact, they've caused some diseases that weren't a problem before to become a problem. So even in the limited sphere in which science is very useful, it's still partial. The understanding is still partial. And if the scientists want to say, well, it's partial, but we're expanding that part until eventually we'll see the whole, at least according to Kuhn, that's not the way science works at all. It's not like you understand something partially and then you understand more and more and more until you understand everything. So in general, without spiritual understanding, we're relying on imperfect and limited senses. And this is not only true when it comes to the hard sciences, but it's even more true when it comes to the soft sciences. In fact, many people in the hard sciences consider that the soft sciences, like psychology and sociology, are not sciences at all. When you're trying to understand human behavior, either individually as sociology or collectively, individually as psychology or collectively as sociology, it is impossible to isolate all of the possible factors and to have fully, like a controlled experiment. You know, even in biology, when we're looking at, say, medicine and they have control groups, you know, they'll have one group that gets the medicine, one group that gets nothing, and one group that gets a placebo. But no two people are exactly alike. And therefore, what works on one person may not work on another, not because of the medicine, but because of something inherent in the people. I mean, we do know that, like, people with red hair respond differently to medicines than other people. I don't know if you know that. Like, red-headed people respond differently to anesthesia than other people do. So whatever causes the red hair causes other chemical differences in their body. And women often respond different to certain medicines than men do. And then certain groups, certain races or cultural groups of people also tend to have different responses to medical treatment. And Ayurveda teaches us that this is true not only in groups, but also as individuals. And what to speak of with the body when we go to study the mind and social behavior, trying to figure out, you know, exactly what causes what, and what will cure what, and what means what, is almost impossible. You know, when I did my survey of devotee teachers, I simply asked them, are you a member of ISKCON? You know, we have these discussions, what does it mean to be a member? And my answer is, if you say you're a member, you're a member. If you say you're not a member, you're not a member. That was pretty simple. But somebody could argue, well, you say you're a member, but you're not really. which on one level makes sense and on another level is ridiculous. So, you know, depending on how you want to look at it. On one level, I may know more about whether you're a member of ISKCON than you might know. That might be the case. And on another level, how can I know more about how you affiliate yourself than you do? So how do you answer these questions? You know, we do the best we can with the soft sciences, but anyone who thinks that the results attained through soft scientific research... Oh, and then on top of that, in most of the soft sciences research is done with a small group and then extrapolated to a larger group. So in qualitative research, you're not supposed to do that at all, although people do all the time, informally. Qualitative research is just where you interview people. You don't analyze the research statistically. So to analyze research statistically, there's all these rules you have to follow. You have to pick a random sample. I mean, it's... And then the idea is that if you follow these rules of what's called qualitative research or research you can analyze statistically, you're supposed to come up with something where you study 200 people, but on the basis of those 200 people, you're supposed to be able to say this is true about 2 million people. Now, the problem is that in a lot of this research, the more it's repeated, the more the results disappear. What often happens in research is the first research that shows something gets published and gets talked about. And when people repeat the experiment, no one's interested to publish it because it's kind of old news. But science is supposed to be about repeating. And what happens is when the experiments are repeated, especially if this has to do with psychology, sociology, or biology and medicine, the results often disappear. And nobody exactly knows why. My own theory about it is that I'm doing work with 20 people or 200 people, but then the next researcher picks a different group of 200 people, and the next group picks a different group, and the group that we took in the beginning didn't really represent the population. And so as you start taking different groups, often the results disappear. It's actually quite a common phenomena and quite worrisome to people in science. So what Srila Prabhupada is saying here, without Krishna, all our knowledge is either false or partial, is something that's very much understood in the scientific establishment. It may not be advertised to the general public. You know, if you go to primary school, they're not going to tell you that all of our knowledge is false or partial. Everything we're teaching you is incomplete at best. And everything we're teaching you is subject to change. You know, and I talk about many times how what's right in society changes dramatically. What we think is right, what we think is wrong, what we think is moral, what we think is ethical, good and bad. The change is phenomenal. You know, as I was saying with medicine, I grew up thinking that antibiotics and vaccines were the most wonderful thing on the planet. That was the mood when I was a child. And, you know, having synthetic food was also just wonderful. To make food with chemicals without using agriculture. That this was a wonderful thing. So, and now nobody thinks these things are wonderful anymore. They see that they're a mixed blessing at best. So these things, they totally shift. What to speak of social behavior, what is acceptable social behavior. And whatever time we're in, we think, it's obvious. The truth is obvious. Of course it's like that. But people 20 years before didn't think that way. And people 20 years from now will not think that way. So materially, our senses are dependent on the Lord and they are very imperfect. The takeaway from this is don't take one's own senses and mind very seriously. I find it astonishing that although what I've just said is said thousands of times in the Hare Krishna movement, Somehow many of us think that what I've just said applies to somebody else. It applies to those scientists. But it doesn't apply to me. The point of talking about these things is not to criticize the scientists who, after all, are doing their best and have improved our quality of life in so many ways. The point is to look at our own selves and say, even if great scientists, with all their learning and intelligence and instruments and care and sacrifice, are able to get at best partial knowledge, which is subject to be changed, then what knowledge do I have? Why am I so sure that I know? So I like to talk about how I was having a conversation with my youngest son one time. I do not remember the topic. And he said, "Mata, are you sure?" And I said, "Yes, I am sure." And he had a pause and he said, "Are you 100% sure?" So he's a very smart and a knowledgeable person. So when he asked me, "Are you 100% sure?" I also paused and said, "Well, maybe 95%. And of course, I was completely wrong. So I find it very, very interesting that one can be in the Hare Krishna movement for 10, 20, 30, 40 years and still take one's own opinion and one's own perception so ridiculously seriously. You know, even we're reading the books and we decide, this is what Srila Prabhupada said, and this is what he means. And my response is, no, that's your understanding of what Prabhupada said and what Prabhupada means. It's not that my understanding is not, I'm really sorry to have to tell people this, my understanding, your understanding, your understanding is not total truth. It can't be. It's just simply physically impossible. So this is called practical humility 101. You know, it's humility isn't just, no, you take the cushion, let me wash your plate. I mean, that's nice. I'm so fallen, Prabhu. You know, that's nice. We're not disparaging our ISKCON humble culture. I just read a whole article done by a researcher, not a devotee, researched in Mayapur, and one of the articles was about our humble culture. He called it failing well. That in ISKCON we make an art of our failure. We have made a whole system for how to describe our fall downs, our inner anarthas, and it was absolutely fascinating article. I really enjoyed reading it. But even with our whole culture of humility, and I guess I was acting out of envy. Oh, I guess I'm, you know, so sorry, Prabhu, I offended you. I was just being envious, which no materialistic person ever says anything like that. Still, I see in ISKCON, we tend to take our point of view very, very seriously. And we have huge battles in person, in print, on social media, in classes, anywhere we can possibly get a platform. We push that my way of understanding Krishna consciousness is the way. My vision, my understanding is the absolute truth, and I can quote lots and lots of verses to prove it. And your understanding is not. And if we have a disagreement, then I say, naturally, you must be in Maya. And that extends, one can say, well, Anila, that's on the platform of without Krishna, Prabhupada's saying here. But with Krishna, we can have full knowledge. So therefore, if you're Krishna conscious enough, If your 16 rounds are attentive enough, if you're following the regulative principles is seamless and, you know, without struggle, if you only eat prasadam, then you transcend your imperfect senses. Don't you know that? And because I have such good, impeccable, amazing sadhana, therefore my understanding is correct. And if you disagree with me, that must mean that your sadhana stinks. My evidence that you're in maya and you're illusion. Or maybe it's not your sadhana, maybe you're offensive. Maybe you're disloyal. There's something wrong with your spiritual life. And this is what's going on in our Hare Krishna movement. When we have differences of opinion, when we have different ways of understanding things, when we have different visions, we assume that my vision is right because I am Krishna conscious. And if you have a different opinion, you must not be Krishna conscious. This view of putting so much faith in our own perspective, our own understanding, is so damaging to our society and so at odds with our philosophy. I would really like it if we would expand our humble culture, which I think is one of the nicest things about ISKCON, is our humble culture, even though sometimes it's a little silly. But if we could expand this humble culture to our opinions, I think it would be one of the most wonderful things that we could do in ISKCON. You may know that I had the Shastric Advisory Council to the GBC, and we've been working for quite some time on a system of hermeneutics, which is basically what are the values, principles, and rules for understanding the statements of Shastra, Srila Prabhupada, and our Acharyas. And I think it's going to be a while before we're ready to really present this and teach this in the society. But one of the main values is that I don't understand everything. And there's unity in diversity. There can be many true understandings. Like in this verse, the residents of Dwarka are lamenting when Krishna goes to Mathura, Vrindavan, or Hastinapur. But the residents of Mathura are lamenting when Krishna's in Dwarka. You know, what's joy for one group of devotees is lamentation for another group of devotees. So such is true even on the highest platform. Even the residents of Mathura and Dwarka and Vrindavan have subjective understandings of the Lord. Just like we hear about when the Lord appears in Kamsa's wrestling arena, and the different persons there, many of whom were pure devotees, their perception of Krishna was different. And the perception of what pleases Krishna is different. Rukmini's way of pleasing Krishna and Satyabhama's way of pleasing Krishna are different. Some of the cowherd boys, it's explained by Rupa Goswami, like to argue with Krishna, and some are very submissive. And Krishna's pleased by both of them. And you can't really say, oh, Krishna's more pleased. No. Krishna loves all of his devotees. And he enjoys varieties of rasa. And so therefore, there's even differences of opinion in Goloka Vrindavan about how to please Krishna. Some devotees feel, well, Krishna's really pleased in this way. And he is. They're right. And other devotees say, Krishna's really pleased in this way. And he is. And they're right. Now, Krishna's personality, Rupa Goswami explains, he has four aspects of his personality which appear contradictory. He is Dhirodhata. Dhirodhata is the hero. Ramachandra exemplifies Dhirodhata. Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill. Krishna is the supreme king. Krishna is also Dhirodhata. Dhirodhata is exemplified by Bhima. And this is, how would you say? Krishna is the tough guy, almost the bad boy. You know, willing to be mean and nasty even. To insult the demons. So Dhirodhata is, everything is dharmic. But Dhirodhata, he's willing to go to the demons and say, you're a dog. You should be fed to the dogs, like the way Krishna talked to Pandraka. Yes, Dhirodhata seems to be very arrogant and nasty. And you know, you think of the, in modern days, some of the heroes, they were like ex-criminals and they ride a motorcycle, but they still kill the bad guys. You know? And then you have Dhiraprasanta. Dhiraprasanta is the gentleman. This is exemplified by someone like Yudhisthira. When Krishna's washing everyone's feet at the Rajasuya Yajna, he's in this mood of Dhiraprasanta. And then there's Dhiralalita. Dhiralalita is exemplified by Cupid. So this is the party boy, the fun boy. This is Krishna dancing with the gopis. This is Krishna playing with the cowherd boys where, you know, they take the vegetables out of the samosa and put jasmine flowers in it and play tricks on each other. So, and these appear to be contradictory. How can Krishna be both Dhiraprasanta, the consummate gentleman, and Dhiralalita, the consummate party boy? How can he be the dharmic hero, the gentleman, the soft gentleman, the wild party boy, and the nasty, arrogant, tough guy? How can he be all of these? Like among the Pandavas, Yudhisthira is the gentleman, and Bhima is the tough guy. And they don't combine into the same people. So even on the spiritual level, some devotees relate more with Krishna in one way than another. And Lord Kapiladev says Krishna takes a form that's suitable for each devotee's worship. And Sanatana Goswami explains in commentary on 10th canto, 14th chapter, that each jiva is attracted by a particular quality of the Lord. You know, those who have a rasa with Krishna of comedy, they deal with the Lord very differently than those who have a rasa of chivalry or ghastliness, which I was just hearing Prabhupada speak about this morning. So even those who do see the absolute truth by the grace of the Lord, each of us see the absolute truth somewhat differently. Because we're persons. So materially, our understanding, our vision is so flawed. Although we can act on it for practical purposes, we should never become proud of our way of understanding and never become convinced that our way of understanding is the only way of understanding. It's just almost unlimited arrogance to think in this way and damages our relationships with the devotees. Nor should we expect that if we were all fully, absolutely Krishna conscious, 100% on Krishna prema, that then we would all agree about everything. It's not that our disagreements come entirely from illusion. So our disagreements come from illusion and imperfect senses, but they also come from the fact that we are persons. And we have a very personalistic philosophy. Ultimately, of course, the residents here are saying, without you, it's as if we're just not even functional. So this kind of love for Krishna, that without you, I have eyes, but I'm blind. I have ears, but I'm deaf. My senses are not operating. Sunyayitam jagat sarvam govindavirahinam. We talked about this a lot yesterday, so I didn't want to bring it up so much again today. But this concept that really everything in my life only has meaning with Krishna. That's on the level of our knowledge about the world, it's on the level of our knowledge about spirituality, and it's at the level of our emotion. It's at the level of our life. Without Krishna, without the Lord, nothing has any meaning, nothing has any value. And when we are fully, fully convinced of that, of course, then we see Krishna everywhere. And we understand everything, although even when we understand everything, it's according to our individual perspective. So, questions, comments? Yes, Prabhu.
This is a perfect moment to ask this question. Is Krishna partial or is he impartial? My definition of partiality is that he tries to cheat someone.
Okay, so is Krishna partial or impartial? And your question, I'm just repeating it for people who are... This is being broadcast, yeah?
Yes, that's what I mean.
So you said, is Krishna partial or impartial? And your definition of partiality is that he tries to cheat somebody. Is that the end of your question?
Yeah.
Well, in that case, he doesn't like anyone. Because he cheats Radharani and Mother Yasoda also. Mother Yasoda puts him to bed at night. And he says, now Mother, please leave and let me sleep. And then he gets up and he goes out the window and he goes and meets the gopis. So he's cheating Mother Yasoda. She sees him in the morning. Sanatana Goswami explains this in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. She sees him in the morning and she sees that he's dirty. That was because he was out dancing all night. And she thinks, oh, he didn't get a proper bath last night. And she gives the servants a hard time. Why didn't you bathe him properly? He's cheating her. And he cheats Radharani. He says, I'm going to meet you over there. Sends a message. I'll meet you over there 8 o'clock. He doesn't show up until 2 in the morning. And we have that nice exchange that's in Nectar Devotion where Radharani says, you know, where were you? And he uses the word residence. And he says, you know, to also can apply to fragrance and what was the other thing? I think clothing. You know, and he answers according to these other meanings. And finally, when she keeps persisting, he says, my residence is in your eyes. And then she says, you know, where were you all night? And he changes the meaning and says, you know, how could night have kidnapped me? And then she starts laughing. But he cheated her. He said, I'm going to come, and he doesn't come. And he does this all the time. You know, if you read Vidugdha Madhava, he runs into Chandravali and calls her Radharani and offends her. And then he runs into Radharani and calls her Chandravali and offends her. He's doing this constantly. So Krishna's constantly cheating everybody. So then, according to your definition of partiality, Krishna doesn't like anybody. So would you like to try to refine your definition of partiality? For your understanding. I mean, maybe when Krishna says he has no friends and no enemies, it means he just plays games with everybody. You know, this topic of Krishna's partiality is very much what leads to the story of Hiranyakashipu and Nrisingadev. It's that question, is Krishna partial? Because it seems that the demigods usually, not always, but it seems that the demigods usually win. And the demons are usually defeated. Again, not always. The demons do become victorious for certain periods of time. It's not that the demigods are always victorious. But the answer is that the world is set, if we look at the material world, the world is set up to favor the mode of goodness, which isn't partiality, because if you think, what does the mode of goodness mean? Sattva means that which is true. So you're saying, the way things are favors what the way things are. It's basically a tautology. And the example that I always give is if you walk through the doorway, you're happy, and if you try to walk through the wall, you're unhappy. And it's not that the architect or the builder was partial. Now, of course, if you make, like what happened in the palace of the Pandavas, if you make the floor look like water and make water look like the floor, then you could say, well, there's partiality because you're obscuring truth. The fact that truth favors truth is not partial. but if truth favors truth but looks like something that's untruth, then you have a problem. The difficulty here is that a conditioned soul does not wish to see truth. That is the definition of a conditioned soul. The conditioned soul basically says, I don't want to see truth. You could say, why would anyone do that? And my answer is, why does anyone take intoxicants? Because that is exactly what intoxicants do. Intoxicants make you see untruth, correct? That's their purpose. That's why people take them. Because they're tired of seeing truth. They want to see untruth. Why is there such a big movie industry? A multi-billion dollar movie industry. Do you know there's a huge industry just in making movie trailers? Mm-hmm. It's a huge industry just to make the advertisements for the movies. Why does that exist? Now, some movies are portraying things that are true, but the vast amount of movies that are made are portraying untruth, yes? And there's no Batman. It's a lie. There's no Superman. There's no James Bond. It's false. But why are people, they want to see untruth? They're paying their money, whatever it costs to see a movie, I have no idea. They're paying their money and their time to be absorbed in untruth. So why are we surprised that we want to see untruth? Well, if you want to see things differently than they are, because everything favors the way it is, then you suffer. And you may say, God has cheated me. No. He says, if you want to see truth, you can see truth. If you want to see illusion, you can see illusion. That's available. But if you perceive things as illusion, then you'll deal with them wrongly. By definition, as soon as you see something different from what it is, you'll not deal with it correctly. It's just logical. But if I see things the way they are, I cannot for one moment maintain that I'm the center of the universe and I'm the enjoyer of material nature. I can't maintain that mentality, not even for a fragment of a second, if I perceive things the way they are. So that's not Krishna cheating us. It's us cheating ourselves. And if Krishna did not facilitate illusion, then he would also be partial. He's impartial, that if you want to perceive things in an illusory way, that's also available. Ye tamam prapajante tam sitaiva bhajamyam. Krishna reciprocates. Krishna basically, eko bhavanam yovidadati kaman, he gives us whatever we want. And he advises against it. He gives us good advice. But he does give us whatever we want. So if we want something that's completely foolish and stupid, that's not his partiality. You know, if somebody wants to take, you know, meth and heroin, and that's their utter stupidity. It's not the fault of God who created the opium poppy that people take heroin. You know, it's not, you can't blame Krishna. Well, why did you create opium poppies? They're useful. You know, without opium and its derivatives, we would have difficulty. It's useful as a medicine. You know, opium is the only cure for very severe diarrhea, for example. So, it has its use. It has its use in dentistry and medicine. We'd be very sorry if this wasn't available to us. But that doesn't mean one should misuse it and become a heroin addict. So that's not God's partiality. But I don't see that Krishna cheats anybody. I mean, spiritually there's Leela, which everybody knows, and it's just a game. that they're playing. And it's a game that everybody wants to play. Like in this world, you know, you play a game with somebody and you become their opponent. You're not their opponent. Like who's of those big sisters, Serena and whatever it is?
Williams.
Williams, yeah. Venus, Serena and Venus, yeah. So if they're playing against each other, they're acting as if they're opponents. And they're genuinely trying to win, I would assume, yeah. But they're friends, they love each other. It's play. It's serious play. They make a lot of money from it. It's their job. But it's still play. They're not, one would hope and assume that they don't have envy or malice towards each other. One would hope and assume that they're equally happy if the other one wins. And like we were talking about Krishna cheating the gopis, but it's described in Chaitanya Charitamrita in the conversation with Ramananda Roy that the gopis are happier when Krishna enjoys with another gopi. Says Radharani is 10 million times happier when Krishna enjoys with another gopi. So is Krishna cheating her? When Krishna says, I'm going to come and enjoy with you, and instead he enjoys with another gopi and shows up late, has he really cheated Radharani? No, she wants him to enjoy with the other. That's her desire. But it's in this playful exchange. Where were you? Oh, this is my fragrance. Not your fragrance. Where were you? I always live in your beautiful eyes. You know. And they're playing, they're laughing. It's fun. And as far as the conditioned souls, Krishna doesn't cheat us. He's giving us exactly what we want. If you go to a gambling casino and you gamble, is the gambling casino cheating you? No, you know very well that the gambling casino wins. They must. Are they cheating? You know. Isn't that a secret? If you gamble with your friends and they win and they take your money, did they cheat you? You knew they were trying to take your money. Well, you know, you went there. You went to the poker game saying, try to take my money. And I'm going to try to take yours. Krishna says of all kinds of cheating, he's gambling. It's such an amazing kind of cheating because you agree, you know. Go ahead and cheat me. It's crazy. But they're voluntarily. People who gamble, they're voluntarily. People are voluntarily buying food that's not food. If you buy something that says zero calories, it's not food. To be food, it has to have calories. That's the purpose of food. It's like buying non-burning fuel for your fireplace, you know. Looks like wood, but it doesn't burn. You know, that's what non-caloric food is. And if you buy that, have you been cheated? No. Oh, this food made me sick. It didn't make me healthy. Well, duh, it wasn't food. You knew that. It says right on the label, zero calorie food. Krishna, I'm suffering in this world. Well, yeah. Of course you are. It's dukkhalayam. Illusion means suffering. It must. I want to see things in a way that's not true. Well, then you're going to bump your head. Krishna, I'm bumping my head. Yes? So? Please let me continue to be an illusion without bumping my head. Sorry, not possible. So, I don't see that as partial. Is that okay?
Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
When you said that each of us sees absolute truth as different, and that we will never agree on everything.
Nope.
It's So if
unless we're all merged in the Brahman, and then we don't have conversations. So you're saying we each see the... can you repeat your question?
Each of us, you said that if each of us sees absolute truth, we'll be different, and
yes,
we will never agree on everything. So if you continue on this thought, that what is the purpose of education, if I will always see something a little different from what you educate me, and that even this seems like it disqualifies anything that is coming to me, because I will always interpret it according to my own way, how I see it.
The purpose of education is to connect us with absolute truth. Absolute truth is personal. Therefore, the purpose of education is to connect us with an infinite variety of understandings within that overall truth. Now, I'm not saying that every understanding is true or every understanding is equally true. That is ridiculous. Even the proponents of post-positivism who don't accept any absolute truth say that it's absolutely, and who say that it's absolutely true that there's no absolute truth. Yes. So even such post-positivists and post-modernists don't accept everyone's subjective opinion and everyone's subjective view as having equal truth value or equal moral value. So the post-positivists do not accept racism and, you know, as being equally valid with compassion. They still have some idea that one thing is better than another. So even those who reject any idea of an absolute truth are not able to get away from concepts of gradations of morals and ethics and goodness. Even they have some idea that some things are true and some things are false. Yes? So we're not saying that that everybody's opinion is equally valid. That's not what we're saying at all. There are things that are universally, objectively true. Like, there's one Supreme Lord. He's big, we're small. The meaning of life is love. The way to attain love is to practice love. That's what Bhakti Yoga is about. Knowledge is coming from the Lord and his representatives and the scriptures. Those are not subjective things at all. They're not subjected to any kind of variance of perception. But that is a short list. It's a significant list. It's the list that frames everything, but it is a short list. Now, if you look at what's an ideal society has four varnas. What does it mean by four varnas? It means four categories of how people see and interact with the world. And within those varnas, there's many, 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 many sub-varnas. And each has a different way of seeing and interacting with the world. And we like that idea, yeah? We think that's a good idea. All right. We talk about 12 rasas. I was just hearing Prabhupada talk about this today. There's 12 rasas. That's 12 broad categories of how to see the absolute truth. And under each of those, there's so many subcategories. Rupa Goswami gives 350 subcategories of Madhurya Rasa, for example. So education is to teach about what is absolute truth that is not contextual, that is not subjective, which is, again, a short list. And then part of that absolute truth is that we are persons. The ultimate truth is a person, and we are all persons. That is a non-contextual, non-time, place, and circumstance, always eternally true. The fact that that is always eternally true then implies that how we approach and understand that absolute truth, who's a person, and I am a person, is going to be personal. So part of education, a large part of education on both the material and the spiritual platform, is to help each person become the highest expression of themselves. The purpose of education is not to make you like me or me like her or everybody like everybody. Of course, modern education, in fact, to some extent, does have that purpose. But the transcendental purpose of education is that everybody should be the top ideal of themselves. So the top ideal of ourselves is spiritual. We each have a spiritual name, form, personality, qualities, and activities. And ultimately, education is to realize that. That is the highest, most true, most perfect expression of myself. Then on the conditioned platform, we also have getting the highest, most perfect expression of our, the most true and most perfect expression of our false self, which sounds very paradoxical. But it's something like, if you're driving a car, you're not the car, but you want to know how to drive the car in the way that you will get the best use of that car. That you will, that the car will not break. You'll not, you don't want to drive the car in a way that will damage the car. You want to drive the car in a way that will best use that car's unique features. Like, I was using a car that had cruise control, you know, where you can set the speed and it drives. But this car not only had cruise control, it could sense the presence of the cars in front of it. And so if there was a car too close, it would slow down the car. So it would slow down and speed up within that range. And, you know, if you know that your car has that feature, then you can use it. So if you just like, if you buy a car, education is to find out what can it do, what are its limitations, what is it used for. So that's also true with our particular body and mind. So education is for that purpose also. What, as Prabhupada would say, psychophysical talents, propensities, nature, inclination, does this temporary body and mind have? It's not me, ultimately, but it's what I'm driving. How can I use this temporary and not me, to function in the world and to help the real me to develop? And so this is training in Varna and in ashram, and even in how we're going to engage in many of the processes of bhakti. And that's the purpose of education. Not to get everyone to understand exactly the same thing in exactly the same way. And any education system which is trying to get everybody to understand exactly the same thing in exactly the same way is itself untruth. I mean, there's a plant right there. That's a real plant, yeah? Right there next to you, is that a real plant?
Yes.
Can you find any two leaves on that plant that are identical to each other in every respect? And that... No. And that's on the same plant. Then if you look at that plant, which is behind you there on the altar, right next to the altar, that plant, the leaves are so different from these leaves. Why? They have the same function. Why are they so different? Krishna seems to like variety. Seems to be a thing with him.
He has a problem.
He has a problem with it, yeah. I mean, it's not very efficient, you know. It's really not very efficient. We should educate Krishna in the factory model, you know. Where all the parts... I mean, we should teach him that this is such an inefficient system. That at least on one plant, every leaf should be exactly the same, you know? He's got to follow Henry Ford and start the factory system. Obviously, it's not his mentality. His mentality is, Krishna likes individuality to that extent of making each leaf on the same plant different. Why? Who cares? How many of us look at each leaf? I mean, who is it that's appreciating this? I always use the example of snow. Each snowflake is different. Why? Who's looking at them? Obviously. But I'm not. Are any of us looking at every single snowflake is different? Why? And they're so temporary. If I was going to make something that temporary that nobody paid any attention to at all, I would make them all the same. But that's not what he does. He makes them all different. So if you have any education that's aiming for sameness, that education, by definition, is false. It's not in accord with the way things are at all. You know, I was reading, one doctor wrote this, a book about problems in modern education, and she said, if your ideology does not match biology, there's something wrong with your ideology. So again, what's Maya is something that's not in accord with reality. Reality is diverse to an extreme. I mean, it's really diverse. It's not like slightly diverse. It's not like each of us are just slightly different. We're radically different. All right? Very good? Yeah, that's the... The best teachers help everyone to become the most ideal version of themselves. Success is when you are the most perfect version of yourself, which will look quite different than the most perfect version of somebody else. Becoming a pure devotee, we know it's not that when we become pure devotees that all of a sudden we are all exactly the same. Look at Bhima and Yudhisthira. They're both pure devotees. They're radically different people. They respond to situations often in opposite ways. Yeah. Oh, wait. Microphone. That's for the online people. Hello, online people.
You were stating that everybody perceives absolute truth in a different way. But in Prabhupada's commentaries, we can see that he was mainly using commentaries or perceptions of the previous acharyas. What should be our attitude regarding that? Should we search for a person whose perception corresponds with ours?
Well, that's not possible.
Or we should accept the perception of our temporary authority. Or we should look for our own perception of that.
All three. So ultimately in bhakti, we are supposed to meditate on the devotees who have our same mood in serving Krishna. In fact, that is the practice of Raganuga Sadhana. What one of the factors that differentiates Vaidhi Sadhana from Raganuga Sadhana is in Vaidhi Sadhana you're just a devotee, but in Raganuga Sadhana you've realized, I'm one of Krishna's parents. So you meditate on Nanda Maharaj, or you meditate on Yasoda, because they have a mood similar to yours. And eventually you realize what particular group you're in, and you meditate on the leader of the group that is similar to yours. And even in this world, why are you in ISKCON and not in another group? I assume because there's some similarity. Yeah? Why do people join other groups? There's other Gaudiya Vaishnava groups. We're not the only one. Why? They have different moods. It's not that we're right and they're all wrong. I'm not saying every group is right, by the way. There are Upasampradaya groups. I'm not saying everybody who claims to be a follower of Lord Chaitanya is. That's not true. Some of the people who claim to be followers of Lord Chaitanya are preaching rubbish. But there's a variety, like Prabhupada writes in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's many societies of pure devotees. You join a society that resonates with you, and you stay in a society that resonates with you. And within ISKCON, that's also true. Like Prabhupada wrote to Jamuna and Dinatarane. They said, Prabhupada, you know, is it okay that it's just the two of us? How are we going to get devotee association? Because Prabhupada was encouraging them. And Prabhupada said, if two are compatible, you will make all advancement, and if you are with 200 that are incompatible, you won't make any advancement. So we're not going to find another jiva who completely has our point of view. That's impossible. We each have a unique point of view. But we certainly are supposed to be with like-minded persons. That's one of the instructions of our acharyas. Okay, so that's true both in Vaidhi Bhakti and in Raghunuga Bhakti. Your other question is, should we accept the view of our temporary authorities? Well, as far as smooth running and not having chaos in the world, everybody needs to do that. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them about everything. But if everybody disobeys their authorities whenever they disagree, the whole world would fall apart. Because we're not going to agree with our positional authorities about everything. That is impossible. You can never agree with another jiva about everything. Prabhupada says that difference of opinion is a symptom of being a person. He wrote in one letter, he said, you and your husband are both devotees. That does not mean you agree about everything. Difference of opinion is due to being a person. So whether your temporary authority is your father and mother, or your husband, or your temple president, or the head pujari, or the GBC, or the president of your country, or the police officer who stops you on the side of the road, whoever your positional authority is, if you don't cooperate with them and work with them, everything is chaotic. It doesn't mean you have to agree with them all the time. Now, if you think they're making a very severe moral or ethical mistake, then there's processes to redress that. There's processes to bring that up and deal with it in a civilized way. It's not that we obey our positional authorities blindly. Prabhupada says blind following is condemned. But nor should we blindly rebel against them. Then it's nothing goes on. If people don't cooperate and obey, you can't do anything. Anything. You can't accomplish anything as a group without some leaders. There's a book, one of the books we read also in the doctoral program, was called Lead, Follow, or Get Out of the Way. So it's a very famous book. So, you know, if you are in a position of authority, you have to keep in mind that your title does not confer upon you more intelligence, more insight, or more anything than anybody you are leading. People who think that their positional title has made them more qualified are raging idiots. It's simply for the smooth functioning of society. Somebody has to be in charge. That's all. That's all. It's nothing else. Yes, you know more about some things, but the people you lead know more about some things also. Everybody has expertise in different areas. So just because a person by temperament, by nature, by willingness will take a title of authority doesn't mean anything other than they've taken that particular responsibility. They should not be proud thinking they know more than anybody else, and other people should not be in a position of either blind following or rebellion, but in a mood of cooperation. And then you had another question, is should we take that Prabhupada referred to the opinions of previous acharyas, should we also? Yes, of course. But the acharyas don't always agree among each other. Of course they don't. They're people. They all agree about the absolute truth. Prabhupada would say, you know, Ramanuja, Madhvacharya, they all agree. Do they agree about everything? No. But they all agree that there's a God. There's one God. It's a person. The supreme manifestation of God is a person. We're part of God. The highest thing is love. That everybody agrees on. But the details, those different. Do we have to agree with all the previous acharyas on all the details? Well, that's going to be very difficult because the previous acharyas don't agree with each other about all the details. So with which previous acharya are you going to agree about which detail? And guess what? As you become advanced in Krishna consciousness, you're going to have more and more of your own understanding from your own relationship with Krishna. That will also happen. That's supposed to happen. If it doesn't happen, something is wrong.
The teacher.
The teacher.
Something is wrong with someone else.
Something is wrong with someone else. Now, maybe when one first takes up Krishna consciousness, it's useful to say, there is only one way of understanding and I just simply have to memorize it. Maybe that's useful in the first month or two or year, but eventually that becomes a very strange kind of fanaticism, which causes us to become arrogant, to be offensive to others, and to fail to progress in a personal system of understanding the absolute truth. Now, if you want impersonalism, that is also available. Just like illusion is available. Krishna is not partial. Illusion is available. Impersonalism is also available. There is the Brahma Jyoti. You can go there. It's hard to stay there. That's another problem. Generally, the souls don't stay there. But you can go there. In the Brahma Jyoti, everybody has the same opinion. Because nobody has any opinion. They're just there. They don't express any opinion. Now, on the positive side, there's no quarrels or disagreements. Everybody sees everything exactly the same way. On the negative side, you're just there. You're not doing anything. You're not relating to anybody. It's true that in the Brahma Jyoti, Krishna will not tell you he's coming at 8 and show up at 2 in the morning. That won't happen. You don't have to worry. Maybe Krishna likes the other gopi better and he's cheating me. There's no lila in the Brahma Jyoti. So if people are really looking for some kind of objective experience where everybody agrees, you know, that is also available. It's not like that's not available. It is available. Even if you want to be part of the Paramatma, you get that to a lesser degree. You don't get the full range of Krishna's personality in Paramatma. You know what, Prabhu? It is 9:22, and I know much to tell Magatha Pranam Boryas Praspara Katyan Chastamam Nityam Tushanti Charamanti Char. But there's also Yagdesh Yastasina Santo Muchite Sarvakil Bishai Bunjite Te Tubam Papa Ye Puchantiat Makaranat. So I think we should move from the Machchita Magita Pranam to the Yagyashishta Shina Santo verse of the Bhagavad Gita. So thank you very much, Prabhupada.